Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, June 7th, 2013. And the main science topic tonight, I will be talking more about tornadoes and the true cause of tornadoes, how space weather affects tornadoes, and the ongoing and really, I don't know if it's humorous, statements where the National Weather Service is promoting through its minions out there, the little reporters, the weather reporters around the world. I don't call them weathermen anymore. I call them weather reporters because they are basically told what to say. Their education is tainted because they're learning, really, science about meteorology that doesn't work, and they're not smart enough. Here's what happens when, say, a meteorologist or a geologist or even a space scientist or an astronomer goes for advanced education. Okay, you get your college degree, you're good at that, oh boy. Somewhere in that college degree, you have stopped taking science. You may have taken a physics course, you might have taken two, like 101 and 102 basic physics. Maybe didn't do too good, but most of it's forgotten water under the bridge. And so now you're going to advanced school, meteorology, geology, space science, astronomy. And there's something missing. You've stopped taking math courses. You never took logic. You don't understand if, therefore, tautologies. Okay, now you're going to take your advanced degree, and what do you get? You get a textbook. You get a professor. You get the amazing amount of top-down education that comes from the federal government. And all of this, all of these fields are controlled, which I learned when I was at Cornell, is that the astronomy community forces onto all of the other fields, including history, history of man, including religion, the idea that the solar system all began 4.5 billion years ago, the universe supposedly began in a big bang 12 billion or some number of years ago. Every year it seems to grow a bit. But, you know, eliminating the concept of real actual science. Who was here billions of years ago to witness the Big Bang? Well, they're measuring secondary and tertiary effects and saying this supports their theory. There's nothing proven. There's no observation. Believe me, there's nobody I know that's in the astronomy community. I know some of those guys are old out there, but they weren't around for the creation of the universe. So we don't have direct measurements. We do have direct measurements of planetary systems creating. We have direct measurements of solar system elements being created. But they deny it because it doesn't fit into the standard theory, and thus it is with meteorology. They teach meteorology that is basically 50 years old. Couldn't possibly be true at all. And, for example, the formation of tornadoes, these clouds rub by each other. Look on the internet and look at tornadoes moving across the plains. There's dozens and dozens of very good tornado movies, videos on the internet. Just look at them. There's no cloud system, one moving by the other one and causing the rotation. No. These are individual clouds moving in a straight line, and all of a sudden a tornado drops down out of that cloud. Not all of them, some of them, but what's causing that? It's not weather systems moving one against the other one. No. There's also some very good videos of lightning associated with tornadoes. Why is lightning associated with tornadoes? There's no reason. There's no battery mechanism in clouds rubbing against each other. And then why should this electricity, even if it were generated, shoot out of the clouds? Batteries, before they will shoot electricity out of a battery, if you took, and you know, your 1.5 volt battery that you hold in your hand, you put in your flashlight, if you could make a million volt battery, let's say, the million volt battery, and maybe it's a little bigger, or a capacitor, okay, it's got two terminals, one on each side of the battery. And you, it's got a million volts. That battery, unless you put a wire, some easy path of conduction from one end of that capacitor, one terminal to the other one, that capacitor or battery is going to try and discharge internally, and it's going to. There's going to be a finite resistance in the capacitor, in the battery, and it's going to drain internally. Those electrons are going to try and move inside the device. So where in the universe does this concept come from? I was at an American Geophysical Union meeting one time. It was, where was it? I think it was in Florida. That's right, we were in Florida. I was at my poster session and teaching some young graduate students who were becoming PhDs and getting their PhDs. I was teaching them about cloud structure. And what happens, a guy comes along, and he's obviously a mentor for the graduate students. And so we start talking, and on my poster, it's the same picture of volcanoes, the South American, I think they're in Chile, volcanoes. If you look at my big poster, you can actually see a small model of it on my sales page down at the bottom where the posters are. There's a picture of a volcano in Chile, and the lightning is shooting out of the clouds, and I'm instructing the graduate students who are around me there about the nature of volcanoes and electricity, that it comes from outside the planet, ultimately comes through the ionosphere, and the electricity is shooting out all sides of the plume, the cloud that's above the volcano. Okay. And so along comes their mentor, and he gets very angry. And he's saying, well, this is thoroughly proven that this electricity is generated in the plume. The updrafts of the plume are generating this electricity. And I go, but wait, the electricity is shooting out of the clouds, and every graduate student there looked at me, and they turned to him, and they said, yeah, the electricity is shooting out of the cloud. Something obviously obvious to, patently obvious to anybody who understands physics. So these were good physics students. These were PhD physics students dealing with meteorology and space science and solar physics. And they all understood what I was saying. But here you have their mentor demanding that they change their opinion to comply with the standard knowledge, so-called knowledge, that the lightning is formed in this tumultuous plume above the volcano, and the lightning therefore can shoot out the sides. Anybody who has any kind of understanding of electricity understands that it's going to follow the path, the shortest path between those electrical poles. And in a battery, internal battery, it's always going to discharge internally. It's not going to shoot out outside of the battery. It's going to, those electrons are going to try and work their way. And as I said, any like plume above a volcano, battery in your hand, a million volt battery in, that you create, is, always has a finite, meaning not infinite, resistance internally. And so it's going to try, those electrons are going to be fighting in there, trying to move towards the positive pole and neutralize the charge. That's what they're going to try and do with tremendous force. There's no reason for them to jump outside the battery and magically go outside the battery and complete a circuit somewhere else. There's absolutely no reason for that. When the so-called voltage, the charge separation is occurring inside a battery like a plume above a volcano. The fact that the lightning shoots out the sides of the plume absolutely proves that this is coming from an external source, and that the plume is nothing more than a conductor in a much larger circuit. End of story. Basic 101 physics, but as I'm saying, your meteorologist who has gotten his meteorology degree from a standard university is going to get on the evening news and point to those tornadoes and give you some song and dance. And this is, I was on the John Moore show, and a woman called in and was talking about when she was a little girl, they used to tell her, or was this Joyce Riley a week ago, I believe? I think I mentioned this last week. The woman said, they used to tell us during a tornado to open the windows. That would allow the air pressure from the house out and save the house from exploding. And the National Weather Service guy says, oh, that's old mythology. That's incorrect. Don't do that. Don't open your windows. And so what is apparent is they're forcing this idea that tornadoes, it's the wind damage that's causing the damage from tornadoes. And there again, it's absolutely incorrect. I just made a posting on my webpage, a great photo sent in by a listener, aerial photo over Moore, Oklahoma, where they show the central path of the volcano through that town from a distance, and you can see that the damage is done where the tornado went, and right next to it, the houses are relatively unscathed. Where the 200-300-mile-an-hour winds were, the houses were undamaged, basically, to, you know, shingles lost, you know, maybe some broken windows, some stuff flying around, damaged siding, whatever, sure. But the houses were not torn apart, and that's where the wind was, out on the edge of the tornado. The only damage is where the center part of that twister moved through the town, and that's because of the vacuum at the base of the tornado. That vacuum is caused by uprushing air, and standard meteorology doesn't have an explanation for why there should be a vacuum at the bottom of a tornado of spinning air. Spinning air doesn't cause a vacuum. It's you know, it's spinning air, nothing more. What keeps that spinning air moving? The point is, standard meteorology is giving you a fairy tale science explanation for tornadoes. And so, at any rate, I'll be talking a little bit more about that. There are some announcements I have to make here. First of all, I want to mention, I've talked about this before many times, the military, the resources that go into the military, and primarily the United States that outdoes the entire world in terms of military procurement and resource procurement, and how they have people that are, they call them critical, they're like critical elements of their, you know, metals, or materials, chemicals, all kinds of things that are critical to the advancement of the military. And that's all good, except the amount of resources spent is not commensurate with the defense that we are given. In fact, if you look at real defense of the United States, we couldn't defend ourselves against an infiltration of cockroaches, let alone another army. All of our military is someplace else. We have no military here. We have our National Guard, but they are typically used in foreign settings now. The National Guard was never meant to be used that way. They were used to be controlled by the governors. Now it's under federal control. But the resource, the use of resources, and I just want to give one example. There's a battleship, the Missouri battleship, that's in Pearl Harbor. I believe it's the Missouri. There was one that was sunk there, but the other battleship, I think it's the Missouri, is stationed there. So it's a tourist thing. You can go and walk around it. Well, I did that once. And while there, I was on the deck. The whole deck of the ship is wood. And I thought, wow, I would imagine they would have made the deck out of metal. But no, back in World War II, wood was available. But being a person who is familiar with sailboats and ships and boats and stuff, I'm looking at it, and this is teak. This is not just any teak. These are big, big pieces of teak. and I forget how thick they are, a foot thick or whatever. I mean, meant to withstand warfare conditions. The whole deck is teak of this battleship. And now aircraft carriers were done the same way with wood. They were easily repaired. But I talked to the tour guide there, and I said, this thing, this deck is teak. I said, this, you could make, you know, a million sailboats out of the deck wood that's in this, on this ship. And he goes, yeah, back in World War II, this teak came from Burma. And there was a major industry, wartime industry, World War II, of cutting the forest, the teak forest, the naturally occurring teak forest, in Burma, which was, and I forget the name of the country right now. It's not called I can't think of it. My brain isn't working. But at any rate, it was called Burma in World War II. They cut down the teak forests, and now there isn't enough teak in the world to make even one board like that. Let's take another example. The Viking ships. When the Vikings were building their big ocean-going canoes, we would call them the Viking boats, the long boats, which I understand were, some of them were 150 feet long. They were made out of oak. And so these were heavy-duty, very heavy-duty ocean-going craft. And they would work and twist with the waves, and that's why they were called dragon boats, because the front end would be in one angle and the aft end would be at another angle, and they kind of snaked their way through the waves of the Atlantic Ocean. But they were made of oak. Now, you don't have enough oak trees in the entire world because of resource utilization of the modern societies. There's not enough oak in the world to build one Viking boat. The battleships now could never use teak for decking. You couldn't get enough wood for one of those planks. The trees are not big enough. There's still teak available, but I've seen the teak. It's grown commercially. It has about a 25-year growth period. Then they cut it. It's not the big, hard, good stuff that was used on that battleship. So at any rate, resource utilization and the economy, this goes for oil also and other resources. Modern society is simply using too many resources, and the end result is pollution. I'm going to talk in a minute about water the control of water, which is coming up. It's going to be in a community near you very soon. There is a law being pushed around the states, and they're trying to adapt it in various states. And I know many states, thinking this is a progressive law, trying to consider passing this regarding education. That all classes, K-12, that's kindergarten to 12 through high school, all classes must teach the same curriculum. So this would be a national curriculum. And the concept here is that if somebody moves from point A to point B, the kids would be at the same point in school. And this is going to be a national law. I call it the National Stupidity Law. Because here's what's going to happen. And I heard this on a radio station. They were discussing it. And the lady's like, oh, isn't it going to be nice? Now everybody's going to be uniform and educated to the same degree. There was a book. When I was back in college, I read this book by Kurt Vonnegut called Monkey House. It was actually a book of short stories. And in it was a short story, and I forget the title of the particular short story. But it amounted to the following. We had come in society and advanced to the point where of equality, where everybody had to be equal. And so by law, everybody had to act and be dumbed down, so to speak, to the point of the slowest, most least intelligent person so that everybody could be equal. And it's a play on the future. Well, we are in the future, and it's becoming law in our educators and our governors and legislators and president are of the mindset that if you pass legislation where everybody is going to be equal, then they will, we will have equality. This will be better. But what about, this leaves the good student completely out of the picture, because all you're worried about is maintaining the kids that can't make it. They're talking about having universal Spanish in schools instead of having people learn English when they come here. Then you can have a dual language society. Well, dual language societies don't work. That brings down the functionality of the main language. Because in the case of Spanish, I know Spanish very well. Spanish is a very weak language technologically. I used to teach in Spanish in foreign countries. I used to teach in other languages in other foreign countries. Foreign languages are very weak technologically. That's why English is the universal technical language, because it's very complicated. It adapts very quickly to new terminology. And if there's an understanding that a term that's been used for 100 years for something might all of a sudden be used for something else. And so in the context, you understand which meaning you're dealing with. Other languages don't have that flexibility. They're very structured. They're very limited. Okay, so English is the technical language. So basically, this is another case where dumbing down or limiting the population because another group cannot bring themselves up to a certain level, instead of being bilingual and learning English, they're going to try and make everybody else learn Spanish, which is absurd. Absurd. I think people should learn Spanish, but in the technical sense, it doesn't make sense. If you're going to advance in the world in technology, you better learn English. All the technical history is there, etc. So, anyway, the law that they're trying to pass nationalized stupidity. And the problem, too, is educators. I really have a grudge against the so-called educators, the people that theorize on how we should be educated. Remember the failure of the new math? Well, this is the next failure on the books. And there's a misconception that you can legislate education. Education happens in the classroom, one teacher with 20, 30 students. That's where education happens. Education happens at home, where instead of playing video games and watching Netflix, you study. It's a concept that, or watching or looking on Facebook. Our students today don't work. They don't do anything, and they can pass. They're being passed because it's the teachers get graded themselves on progress. So if they pass most of their students, that's progress. That's seen as good. But the students don't know anything. They're limiting more and more what they have to learn. The standards are dropping and dropping, and therefore, on the worldwide scale, American students do not fare well at all. Okay, enough of that. On to the next subject. This topic came up. I was on John Moore's show yesterday morning, and a woman called in, and she asked a question, and I made an off-the-cuff comment. Or did I make the comment before she called in? I forget. Yeah, I made the comment before, and I said, do you know that NASA doesn't own the cameras on their spacecraft? They don't own a lot of the equipment on their spacecraft, but specifically I was talking about the cameras. And John goes, well, gee, that's pretty amazing concept that NASA doesn't own the cameras. And I said, yeah, they're owned by a private company. And I said this company is been filtered by a guy named David Malin, and the company is called Malin Enterprises. Throughout my history of observing space information, space photographs, These photographs would come back from the Voyager way back in the early days of the space program, that was searching the planets, etc. And all the photos came from a private company. Even though they came from the satellite, the supposed NASA satellite, the photographs and other data were filtered through private corporations, and specifically the pictures, through a company called Malin Enterprises. And I thought, what the? Here we have billions and billions of dollars going out in NASA, and they don't own the camera that they're taking pictures of, and it goes to a private corporation, and then it comes back to NASA to release. What the heck is going on here? And so anyway, I was mentioning this on the show, on John Moore show, but I just wanted you to know that a very bizarre aspect of NASA is they don't own a lot of the equipment on their satellites, specifically the cameras that take the pictures, and that information comes through a private corporation before it actually comes back to NASA or NASA scientists to look at. So very bizarre. You can strike up your own imagination there. On the crop scene, the severe cold of this year, and this is directed specifically at the global climate change crew out there. Last year they were like, oh, climate change is happening very much faster, etc. And then this year, because we had that tremendously warm, dry spring with the drought all summer, and they're going, this is it. This is climate change. This is global warming. Here we are, greenhouse, stop burning gasoline. And so anyway, then this year we have record cold and wet. A lot of crops, and here's the end result, a lot of crops are not going to be planted this year, especially in the upper Midwest. I understand that the soybean crop, if they will have any at all, is not being planted. Too cold, too wet. The corn crop is going to be severely stunted in many states because of the cold. There have been frost warnings recently in the last couple of days in the northern states. So we're dealing with a cold situation. The sun obviously is variable. And it's something that NASA had an edict some time ago, a number of years ago, to measure the energy output of the sun. Excuse me. Something that you would think would be a fairly easy task, given the space agency staff of physicists, astrophysicists, space scientists, PhDs in physics, etc., what have you. But they have failed to do this. Now, it's very important for us to understand the overall energy output of the sun on a daily basis. We have probably 50 solar observatories around the Earth, many of them funded or partially funded from the United States. And they can't tell us what is going on the sun. I'm not talking about predicting. I'm talking about measuring. They cannot measure and tell us what's going on the sun. Clearly, you can measure down below the atmosphere, but our atmosphere absorbs a lot of the radiation from the sun. You have to get above the atmosphere to really measure the solar output, but they can't do that. But obviously, the solar output is very weak. We just had, let me give a little bit of a solar report here, as the first tropical storm of the season, Tropical Storm Andrea, is moving into Florida from the Gulf side. Understand it's about 100 miles west of Tampa right now. They expect that it could approach hurricane force winds before landfall. But at any rate, the sun had an M-class flare yesterday. I think it was yesterday or the day before in the last couple of days. But an M-class flare is a very standard, average, run-of-the-mill flare at CME. It looked kind of impressive, but we are in a solar maximum. We should have X-class flares. We should have large M-class flares booming out constantly, not one every week. The sun is very weak the sun is very, very weak right now. And I fear that right now we could be heading into a bit of a Maunder minimum. If this cold continues, there's nothing that Monsanto or anybody else can do. The crops are going to fail, and we're going to have worldwide food shortages. The amount of land, if you look at the globe, this is something everybody should do. Look at the amount of tillable land. Now, if in Africa we have the Sahara Desert, most of Africa is not very good agricultural land. It should be, but it's not. The majority of land around the tropical area of the world is very poorly underutilized. Brazil is picking up a lot of the slack, and we're getting a lot of products from South America now, pineapples, for example, strawberries, things like that, other fruits. But the hardcore stuff, the grains, the corn, the soybeans, those products mainly come from the United States, Canada, a bit from Russia, not that much from Europe, but we're talking the northern hemisphere where much of this is grown. A lot comes from China now. But you have a lot of problems with China where they have no pollution control, no control on what you're even getting. Just a little side note here on food. I had a bag of brown rice that I had purchased, and I'm normally very cautious where I buy food like that. But I had a bag of brown rice that I bought from Walmart, and it had some internal damage to it and was older, so I decided to replace it and throw it out. I threw it out on the bank, off to the side of the house, and I noticed something very strange. The birds, the animals, would not eat it. They did. There's birds and animals all around. They didn't touch it. Something like that should be just a feeding frenzy for all the little animals, but they don't recognize it as food. It was hybrid, GMO food. Anyway, just wanted to mention that. But I believe we could be in for a series of wet, cold years and some serious crop failures or just lack of crops. The crops are not even getting in the ground to fail. So that's something that we'll see. We'll see in the future. But a grave problem here, especially this year. This year, 2013, we're going to have a problem with crops. Last year, the corn crop was at about I heard estimates between 20-40% of normal. And so, the price of other products, related product, goes up. It's now said that, one out of every four products in the grocery store contains corn or some extract of corn. Incredible. China this year surpassed production of rice with corn. It's producing more corn than rice. But there again, China has been growing a lot of non-hybrid corn, which is good, but you don't know what else is going on there. You have no control. So even though you think, oh boy, non-hybrid corn, you don't really know what else is going on there or what you're getting when you order from China. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about water. And this morning, an article appeared on CNN that $384 billion, this is an estimate by the EPA, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, that $384 billion, that's about 40% of $1 trillion, has to be spent over the next 17 years to upgrade water systems around the United States that are faltering in danger of pollution. And the reason given, I want you to hear this, I'm going to repeat it 10 times so you listen to this. Population, which is ridiculous because the U.S. population is not growing that much. It's being infiltrated, I would say that. But the base population of the United States is actually declining. It's the illegal alien population, of which we now probably have a good 40 million in the United States. And I'm not going to talk about the immigration laws tonight, but it's just a tremendous mess what's going on in Congress. But the main reason, for this $384 billion investment, or so-called investment spending, I should call it, into water systems is climate change. Okay, I'm going to repeat that 10 times. The reason for the tremendous investment that has to be made, and by the way, this is not investment from the federal government. The population is going to pay for this through the nose in the rising price of water, mainly through homeowners and people who, and then renters, of course, because they pay remotely through the rent that they're paying, because the owner of the complex, rental complex, has to pay taxes or the water bill. And so ultimately the renter will be paying. Anybody that lives basically on a public water system will have to pay. But climate change. Did you hear that? Climate change is the cause, they're saying, of this incredible investment. The EPA has drafted a bill being sent through Congress. It's called, and you better run and hide your head when you hear a name like this, the Safe Drinking Water Act. You know that that has control, control, control written all over it. So climate change, and this is what I've been saying all along, I said it last week on the show, climate change, the world controllers love it, because the next great control of the worldwide population is going to be with water. Not only that, it's the enslavement. Just like you're paying $4.50 a gallon for gasoline, which you don't have to, you should be paying 35 cents a gallon, now the cost of water is going to rise. I know many communities, personally and through friends and other people, where they pay more water now, today. They pay more water, they pay more for their public water facility than they pay for gas, heat, and electric combined. And it's already in place. And the excuse is that, oh, well, the city or municipality had to put all of this investment into the water system due to federal regulations. Now, this started back with Billy Clinton. Good old Billy Clinton did something. He changed the arsenic level requirements. Now, people have been drinking water from these communities, some of them for 100 years, some of them for 200 years. And the water comes from the same well, but old Billy changed the requirement. That raised the standard, so to speak, and made the level of arsenic, he changed it so that the water systems were not compliant. They had to upgrade, so they had to invest in all this equipment. Well, who does that help? Private industry. Who's going to get the bennies from this? And by federal mandate, just create scare in the public, and you can you can take an industry and make it into a like in this case $384 billion industry, and so the companies are already positioning themselves to get in line for this state, federal required upgrades that the communities are going to have to go through, and the price of water is going to go through the ceiling. So these are things, if people are thinking about buying a house in the United States, think again, because the value of the house, you're probably going to lose money, but the utilities are going to start to drive you. You're not going to be able to afford your house because of the utilities, because of heat. If you live in a warmer climate, because of electricity, which comes from the generation of heat and resources. But water, is going to go through the roof. It's going to go astronomical. It's going to go into orbit. And so I just want to mention that the control of water, but I want to repeat again, three times, climate change, climate change, climate change. This was the, this was from the article. Let me get the guy's name here if I can quickly pull this up. Here we are. Said Peter Grevatt, director of EPA's Office of Groundwater and Drinking Water. So states with larger populations have larger needs of money to maintain and update the pipes. Okay, so, but understand that over the many years, these upgrades have not been made. Also, it's not been an ongoing issue. All of a sudden, everybody's in crisis mode. But the end result, greatly increased cost of water. And remember the water metering systems that they, with the radio in them that they wanted to put on everybody's house? In your house with a radio transmitter that can sample the type of toothpaste you're using if you purchased it at Walmart? This is all part of the game, the international control game. Okay, on to discuss a little bit more about tornadoes. Let me make sure. Just a quick comment. I do not post on YouTube. I've told people do not post anything from me on YouTube. I've had an ongoing somewhat battle with YouTube that they know that my material is from my webpage. And YouTube and Google are in cahoots to basically, they're basically owned by the CIA, which is the police force of the world bankers. Same way with Facebook. Look at who owns Facebook now. So the point is, they want to do anything to discredit me, my name. And so I don't post on YouTube. If you see something with my name on YouTube, it isn't me. It isn't me putting it there. They may cut or paste part of my show. People do not have permission to repost my show or any piece of it any place. It's copyrighted. But there again, if I used my resources to start battling Google and Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, I'd be spending all of my research time there. So just a warning. And the other fact is that it's educational for the public. When you see the amount of misinformation being propagated trying to destroy my name, then you'll realize that somebody has a big problem with my success, period. Okay, talking about tornadoes. Tornadoes are not just wind. When you see that swirling cloud, that's the outward observable. Let me use another example, and I got a kick out of this. I asked this question one time in a classroom. I said, what makes a car go down the street? And a girl raised her hand in the class, and she goes, well, the air that's coming out the exhaust pipe pushes the car down the street. And I'm like, well, no, that's an outward sign of something else going on inside the car. The car, she didn't know there was a transmission. She didn't understand what the engine did. All she knew is when you turned the key on, exhaust came out the back end of the car, and so that must be what makes the car go down the road. That's about the level of sophistication of National Weather Service, NOAA, trying to tell people that a tornado is simply swirling wind. And giving you this little textbook illustrated diagram of two storm clouds meeting and therefore causing twisting, rotating air and updrafts, and magically you have a tornado. Absolutely incorrect. None of this would happen on its own if it weren't for outward electrical currents in the atmosphere, and those electrical currents don't just happen. They don't just magically happen. They are driven from outside. They're driven from outside. Okay, so what is the entire process? So this week I'm going to go from a solar system perspective. Okay, we're out in the solar system. And this is very important because I know I talked about this last week, but I want people to get a solar system perspective. We're outside Earth, to, you know, 200,000 miles away. We're watching Earth. And say we could monitor and measure all of the electrical currents passing by us in the solar wind, with solar flares, etc. Okay, and we're going to watch this energy. How does it get down to the surface of the Earth to cause tornadoes, or in the case of today, Tropical Storm Andrea, which is the first, A is the first letter of the season. So right now, early June, we're having the first tropical storm. June to the end of October is the hurricane season. And that's because it peaks in August, where we have the return current sheet in the solar wind. Okay, so let's start at the sun. The sun is throwing out constantly a wind. It's called the solar wind, something that was not known about 50 years ago, but measured more recently with satellites and a bit of understanding coming from standard science. But the sun is pouring out a wind of protons, electrons, and other types of atoms that come out of the solar atmosphere, primarily protons, which is the nucleus of the hydrogen atom, basically. And so it is thrown out and forms a wind. Now this wind comes out somewhat like a curveball. It's not coming directly at us. It is coming out like somewhat in a curveball. With a left spin. So if you're looking from the northern aspect of the sun, that would be the northern side of Earth. Earth would be moving in its orbit in a counterclockwise direction. All of the planets, the big planets, move in a counterclockwise direction around the sun when you're looking from the north. So that's going to be our vantage point. Right now, the Earth pole, the North Pole, is somewhat tipped towards the sun. We are in summer. June 21st is the summer equinox, when the amount of tipping, so to speak, is maximum. The Earth spins on an angle, a 23.5-degree angle, and as it moves around the sun in the winter, the northern hemisphere points away from the sun. In the spring and in the fall equinox, we have equal day. We have the same amount of day as night, approximately within a few minutes. But right now we're in summertime, heading up to the peak day where there's the maximum amount of sunlight in the northern hemisphere. That's the orbit of Earth around the sun. Typically, the solar wind is moving by Earth, and it's a relatively powerful force. It's like a pressure, like a water hose, basically, of charged particles. But there's something that standard science does not understand, something that I had to put together as part of my theoretical work, understanding the electrical nature of the solar system and the cause of weather, for example, one of the end results, the real true cause of comets, that they are electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. And, so there's an excess current that could be velocity, it could be the number of particles, it could be a combination of factors, that there is an excess current, like electrical current, literally electrical current in space, in the form of the positively charged particles, leaving the sun with a slight negative charge. And the question is, how does this happen? That's a very complex story. You can learn about that in my books, read my books, and it goes into a more vivid detail of all of this. But there's an excess positive current in the solar wind. So that creates throughout all of space a battery. The farther out you move, farther out you move to the positive pole of this battery, the sun being a negatively charged relative to this whole system. Balanced, there is an equal amount of charge in the whole system, and this process cannot continue forever. Some current has to return to the sun, and that's where one of the return current sheets occurs, where Earth is in the month of August. So as we move through June 21st, the longest day of the year, and we continue on into August, that's when we max out with the return current sheet. The current flows back from the far region of the solar system, and it flows back towards the sun, maintaining this energy balance. So it's basically a fusion fire in the sun separating charge. Earth and everything else in the solar system passes through this battery, this capacitor. And in doing so, I always use the backyard bug killer example. You have a set of charged plates. The outside plate is at ground so you don't kill yourself. And there's a light in the middle that attracts the bug. When the bug flies through the grating and starts approaching the high voltage grid in the middle, which is just a screen, when the bug flies in there, it extends ground out and zap. The electrical discharge occurs right where the bug is, kills the bug, and the bug falls down dead in a tray at the bottom. The same exact situation occurs in plasma, in outer space. Earth, we start discharging the solar capacitor, there's an electrical current. Let's examine the bug again. What is the main charge carrier in the electrical discharge of the bug? It's electrons. Electrons are much lighter, but they have the same charge, charge as a proton or gas molecules. So electrons are the primary charge carrier. In the case of the solar system, they move out from the sun out towards the Earth. And so that's the main electrical discharge. Now, so we have the solar wind coming by that creates this overall charge, the Earth passing through it, or Jupiter, or Mars, or Venus, or Mercury, or a comet, the same issue. The reason comets charge up much more than Earth is because they're on an elliptical orbit. They're cutting through that potential gradient, the changing electric field of around the sun. So the comets tend to charge up much more. That's also a continued explanation of that, as you'll find in my books on my webpage, by the way, jmccsci.com. But let's take a look at the Earth. We're out here looking at Earth from above and away. The Earth is discharging the solar capacitor. The electron beam, very faint in this case, not as heavy as with a comet, comes out and it electrically charges Earth. Earth's outer ionosphere is simply that. It's a collecting point for this slightly excess current of electrons. Now we have another slight complication. We have a geomagnetic field in the core of the Earth. It's locked into metals, nickel, iron in the core of the Earth, and that geomagnetic field points north. Now, what happens when electrons and protons approach the Earth from the sun in the solar wind? They see that magnetic field, the protons go one way and the electrons go the other way. This augments the Earth's magnetic field. And there are five layers of magnetic field in Earth. There's the geomagnetic field that's locked into the metals in the Earth's surface, in the crust and in the mantle. Then we have the jet streams of air moving in the atmosphere. Couple with this, the northern and the southern jet streams move east. They are positively charged. And the central equatorial jet stream moves west. So these couple, creating a coexisting magnetic field that builds on the Earth's geomagnetic field. So that's layer number two. In the ionosphere, there's another layer of jet streams that move up in the upper ionosphere, the boundary layer with space. Above that, we have the Van Allen belts. The Van Allen belts circle Earth like kind of like Saturn rings with high-energy protons and high-energy electrons. Then we go out from there. There's another system of of plasma magnetic field out from there. And then, finally, we get to the solar wind. When storm systems occur in the solar wind, they can come out and compress our plasma magnetic fields, and those cause changes in the voltage levels in the upper ionosphere. And when cloud systems form in the atmosphere, then they can drive they compress. That changes the dynamics of the Earth's capacitor. And when storm clouds develop, they're like fingers sticking up in the air, just begging for that electric current to come down and pass through them. That's where storm systems develop. That's where the big burgeoning cumulonimbus clouds form. If it weren't for the electric field, the vertical electric field of Earth, none of that would happen. So now you understand the circuit path from outer space all the way down to the circuit of the surface of the Earth, where tornadoes, hurricanes form. That's another story in itself, how all of these storm systems form. I just want to tell you that all of this information and a lot more detail on how this works is contained in my books. The webpage, jmccsci.com. Now all of my books are in ebook format. The latest book, Comets, just recently released, is in ebook format. And if you purchase the complete set of five previous books, the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, the Surviving Planet X Passage pamphlet, Atlantis to Tesla, the Weather book, and the Diamond Principle, those five books, you get the ebook on comets for free. So that's right at the top of my webpage, www.jmccsci.com. And those are also available with a complete set of DVDs and all of my CDs in a set for $140 in hardcover. So at any rate, that on the webpage, that supports this commercial-free show where I can bring you an hour uninterrupted of information every week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.